Hello, and welcome once again to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio. The Friday edition means that it is time for How Music Changed Once Again, which we do every Friday from 5 until 6. We, of course, meeting myself, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife, and co-host Heidi Morales Ryan, who unfortunately is ill today. Under the weather, because the weather's been so weird, I guess. She's home with some sinus issues, so I can fly solo. It's okay. I'm hoping that you were able to catch our show last week. We started a whole new series. We are looking at music of the Delta Blues. We're going all the way back, really, to the beginning of the recorded history of blues from the Delta. Some consider it to be like the birthplace, or certainly the most important fertile ground for the blues. And the main character of our story thus far, it will be Charlie Patton. There will be other people that we will discuss. You might even get into that a little bit later on as the show wears on. But Charlie Patton is going to be our point of focus as we move on. Last week, we were able to play a couple of his songs, along with a couple of songs by actually that predated Charlie Patton and actually wasn't even necessarily weren't Delta Blues. But Papa Charlie Jackson was part of our show. But we're going to pick up where we left off by discussing Charlie Patton first. One thing that we didn't get into at all, it's rather interesting, of course, Charlie Patton being considered a man of African-American descent for the most part. But actually, that's not completely true because he also had partial Indian North American ancestry. His father was of mixed race. In fact, this is, again, taken from the liner notes of a fabulous box set that was put out by Revenant Records. An essay by David Evans called Charlie Patton, The Conscience of the Delta. They're talking here about Charlie Patton's father. His name was Bill. Bill Patton was born in Mississippi in March 1864, and it was stated that he died in 1927 or 1928 in a hospital in Vicksburg. He was a very large man, weighing about 350 pounds, and was described by his grandchildren as having a bright or even red complexion. Bill Patton's father was a white man from Vicksburg, also named Bill Patton, and his mother a black Indian woman named Rose. Rose was likely a slave and Bill her owner. Sexual liaisons between white men and their women slaves were quite common, with some white men openly acknowledging their illegitimate mixed-race offspring. As a result, Charlie Patton had very fair complexion, and it would not have been all that difficult for him to have passed for just a slightly dark-skinned white man, if that were the case, if he were not in the Mississippi Delta. But where he was, he never had any intention of being anything but who he was. It was just an impression that a lot of people had of him. Reading again, continuing more or less through this same essay, it is important to recognize the fact that Charlie Patton's cultural and emotional background was as mixed as his racial background. Even though in the post-Reconstruction South he would have been classified as a Negro, it is not necessarily the case that Charlie accepted this designation. The elder Bill Patton, a white man, and Charlie's grandmother Rose, who considered herself to be an Indian, remained close to their children and grandchildren and visited with them often. There can be no doubt that the white Bill Patton Sr. openly acknowledged his colored progeny. He passed on his surname to his descendants, and his first name, William, or its variants, Bill, Will, or Willie, remained in the Patton family for at least another three generations. The Indian cultural strain in the Patton family is more obscure, and it would have less chance to flourish openly in the Mississippi Valley, where the Indian social presence had been eradicated by the early part of the 19th century. There is considerable evidence in the naming practices, migrational patterns, and oral legends of the Pattons that they resisted the idea of racial classification and preferred to have an ambiguous status and to be considered on the basis of their specific ancestry as well as their actual accomplishments and talents. Indeed, Charlie Patton's entire life and musical output bear witness to this fact, which I think is all obviously quite interesting because Charlie Patton there, not necessarily seeing himself as history has more or less been inclined to see him as the quote-unquote black blues man. He was just lived where he was and was who he was, and that's pretty much all there is to it from his own perspective. Continuing a little bit later on then, some history about him. Despite the relative degree of freedom and opportunity that may have been found in the hills between Vicksburg and Jackson, which is where the Delta was, there appeared to be even greater opportunities in the Delta to the north. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, large parts of the Delta was still swampland. Gradually, a system of levees and drainage ditches was constructed to control the spring floods. The swamps were drained and timber interests cut down the larger trees. After this, the land was carved up into large plantations with incredibly rich soil that had been deposited by years of flooding. Almost all of the land was bought by whites, but Negro labor was needed to cut the trees, till the soil, and pick the cotton. For people living on crowded farms in the hill country to the south, the Delta must have seemed like a dream come true, a frontier paradise with plenty of opportunities for work, where a man's labor might earn him a real sense of freedom and dignity. Along with many others from the hills, Bill Patton, Jr. took his family to the Delta. The year was between 1901 and 1904, and the place where they settled was Dockery's Plantation on the Sunflower River between Cleveland and Ruleville. Dockery's was a huge tract of about 40 square miles, founded in 1895 by Will Dockery. Dockery was a paternalistic planter who, by all accounts, treated his tenants very fairly and frequently gained their loyalty and residency for stretches of many years. He was an extraordinarily well-run and efficient plantation with its own dry goods, grocery and furniture stores, railroad station, a telegraph office, cotton gin, church, graveyard, and picnic ground for the workers and many other amenities. It was really more like a company town in some northern industrial area run by a rather benevolent boss. A number of middle-level positions were held by hard-working Negroes, including members of the Patton family. Bill Patton led a sober life, made money, and eventually was able to buy land near the all-Negro Delta community of Renova, located just north of Cleveland, that's Cleveland in Mississippi, and own a country store there. So, Charlie Patton's family was not, as you might automatically presume, dirt poor. They were actually fairly doing well for a black family in the South. Or a family of color in the South might be more appropriate. Reading about Patton's early experience with music now, going a little bit further in the same essay, we just introduce ourselves to the first track. Patton showed an early interest in the guitar, and around the age of 14, he obtained his first instrument. This was given to him by his father, who had at first strongly opposed Charlie's interest in music and whipped him with a bullwhip. Charlie first played with members of the Chapman family and probably other local musicians around Bolton and Edwards. His sister Viola recalled three Chapman brothers, including Ferdinand, who was born in 1885, and Ezell, who was probably older, along with their father Henderson Chapman, comprising a band of mandolin, fiddle, guitar, and bass violin. In later life, Charlie frequently returned to his boyhood home and no doubt continued to play with these musicians. The Chapmans were an important musical family, and a younger set of Chapman brothers would later become the famous band and recording unit, the Mississippi Sheiks, who we will be covering in this series. Certainly one of the most important of the early country acoustic blues artists, the Mississippi Sheiks. Another very important artist that we'll be covering will be Son House. We'll get into all of that, as I said, a little bit later. Reading on, the role of the guitar in the string band music that the Chapmans played was largely restricted to playing corded rhythm and bass runs. Charlie's sister stated that he didn't really learn to pick a guitar until he moved to Dockery's. There he came under the influence of older musicians living on the plantation who were already developing a blues style of guitar playing. A Mr. Toby, a man named Bonds, whose daughter Charlie married, and most importantly, a man named Henry Sloan. Sloan was born in January 1870 in Mississippi and was living in 1900 in the same community as the Patton and Chapman families west of Bolton. He moved to Dockery's about the same time as the Pattons, between 1901 and 1904. Charlie received some direct instruction, observed and imitated the playing of the older men, and played behind Sloan's field hollers. Sloan and Bonds stayed on Dockery's a number of years, and Charlie had a lengthy opportunity to absorb their music. Evidently, at some point, he surpassed them in ability and reputation, probably by 1910. He was also influencing other musicians like Willie Brown at that time, yet another person we plan to cover in this series. Let's play a track now by Charlie Patton, a song that actually shows some of these very early influences. When we were playing tracks last week by Papa Charlie Jackson, you might have noticed that it wasn't so much guitar as banjo that was the accompaniment. It was Papa Charlie Jackson who was playing a style of music that was considered more hokum than the blues. A lot of blues people tend to push it away as being like a precursor to the blues or an offshoot of it, but not directly the blues. Well, here's Charlie Patton actually playing something that's not totally unlike that style, especially if you'll notice how much his guitar sounds more or less like a banjo on this track. Here's Charlie Patton with a song called Shake It and Break It. There is reason enough for me to basically have a little bit of exception with the blues historians who might have trouble with people like Papa Charlie Jackson because they say that he's not necessarily blues sounding enough, but there's Charlie Patton sounding an awful lot like Papa Charlie Jackson. It's going to be hard to differentiate some of the players by their names. It seems as if everybody who I'm going to be playing for the first couple of shows is going to be named Charlie with a different last name. Charlie Jackson, Charlie Patton, Charlie Jordan. I'll try to clarify that as much as possible as we move along. I'm going to read again from this essay. This is a bit of a long read, so hope you can bear with me, but it's got a lot of important information, again, about the life of Charlie Patton and what it was like to live on the Dockery Plantation in the Delta at that time. Starting now, it is important to realize that Charlie Patton considered music to be a career, a profession. It was not a part-time or a spare-time activity. It was his livelihood, and he rarely did any other kind of work except to help his father. No doubt, like many other professional musicians, He would have considered it a blow to his dignity to have to do any other type of work. His work for his father was mostly done when he was still developing his reputation prior to the early 1920s and was probably done mainly out of a sense of loyal responsibility and when his father was shorthanded for a logging or a farming task. Even beyond his attitude of professionalism, Charlie evidently believed that the life of a musician was his calling. At least, this is the term his mother is said to have used, the same term that one uses for the preaching profession. If Charlie ever had any doubts about this calling, they were strictly over the issue of whether he had a higher calling to preach the gospel. The triumph of Charlie Patton over his environment and social system was that he was able to live at least as prosperously as his father and have a maximum of physical mobility. A Negro landowner had no mobility in this potentially hostile environment, and a renter could only exercise his mobility once a year following his financial settlement with the boss man. Charlie was his own boss man. His niece described his situation by saying, "He just left when he got ready. Because he didn't make no crops, he was a free man." There was, of course, a heavy price he had to pay for his freedom. He had to travel frequently to make money, and he was never able to establish a permanent home or a stable family life. One might wonder why he didn't simply move north, as his brother and sister eventually did. The racial climate was milder in the north, and perhaps he could have become a star there, like Blind Lemon Jefferson, Big Bill Brunzi, or Tampa Red, or taken a factory job and played music on the side. Probably he would have done this if he thought he could live better up north, but the greatest demand for his services was apparently in the Delta. He could make plenty of money there, and he had plenty of friends and relatives in the region. His decision to remain in the South and pursue the career of a musician must be viewed as a step toward greater freedom than he had grown up with, an extension of a family pattern. Perhaps his parents secretly realized this when they finally acquiesced in his decision. There were four contexts in which Charlie Patton played most of his music: cafes and juke houses, or juke joints, honky-tonks, stores, house parties, and picnics. A cafe was a small restaurant catering to black customers serving sandwiches and hot meals, perhaps fried fish or barbecue. A juke joint also served food, but the emphasis was more on music and dancing. In effect, a cafe by day might become a juke house by night. These establishments were operated by blacks and were located in the towns as well as in populated rural areas. During most of the 20s and until 1932, it was illegal to buy or sell liquor in America. Plenty of illegal drinking took place, though, but at the cafes and juke joints, it was generally done on the outside or in a back room, and the liquor was sold by a bootlegger who was usually not formally associated with the cafe owner. During the daytime, Patton probably played mainly for tips, as eating was then the main order of business. Saturday and Sunday afternoons would have been the best times, as most people ate at home on weekdays. On weekend nights, the owner would probably charge admission at the door, and this would be Patton's payment for the night. When he had to travel any distance, he was probably guaranteed a minimum payment. Although Tom Cannon stated that Charlie had a place to play near about every night in the week, he probably seldom played on weekday nights unless he was in a large city, as most people had to go to bed early and work the next day. Playing at a store was similar to playing at a cafe or a juke joint. Most stores, however, were operated by whites and Chinese. During daytime business hours, Charlie would play on the outside for tips from the customers. The store owner would probably give him cold drinks and perhaps a little money if he had a lot of customers that day. A number of rural stores also had a cafe or a juke house area in the back or side rooms. For example, Charlie played in the back of a white-operated store at Holly Ridge, his last residence, and the owner sometimes accompanied him on the fiddle. A house party was basically a private home, temporarily turned into a juke house. The head of the house hired the musician, charged admission, and sold food, with the bootlegger selling liquor outside. House parties were sometimes called country suppers. A picnic, obviously, was an outdoor version of the same thing, held in the warm months. Just as white store owners sometimes operated cafes for blacks, so also did large white landowners sometimes sponsor picnics for blacks. Now, this being the case, obviously Charlie is in a farming community, and not being somebody who cared to work with his hands at all, would still sometimes note what was around him as far as what people were doing. So he ended up writing this song. It's called Mississippi Boll Weevil Blues. It's probably an excellent introduction to Charlie because it you'll hear him talking about the curse of the boll weevil, which was the insect that came in and was eating up all of the cotton that was being planted and making life very difficult for the landowners. And yet, as a musician, you sort of get the feeling that Charlie sympathizes more with the boll weevil than with the farm owner in this song. Here's Mississippi Boll Weevil Blues.
Yeah, the little boll weevil keep moving in the end of Florida. You can plant your cotton and you won't get a heaven sail on her. Boll weevil, boll weevil, why'd your little hole on her? A Louisiana in Texas, little wild, pretty boll on her. Well, I started boll weevil, Lord, I sang a lot of Indiana on her. The next time I see them, Lord, they had his family there on her. Boll weevil left, take a lot of business, my well. Where you going now? I'm going down to Mississippi, gonna get a little down of hell on her. Boy, we look at a boy, they ain't got to get fell on her. Hide that boy, suck all the blossom and leave you a happy square on her. The next time I see you, I had your family there on her. Boy, we a little white witch that I own it, Lord. Boy, we a total wife, let's take this for the end, Lord. Boy, we a total wife, said I believe I'll make a law, Lord. All right, we'll tell all about it. Let's leave Louisiana and go to Arkansas, Lord. Well, I saw the boy weevil, Lord, I sang a lot of Indiana. Next time I see him, Lord, he had his family there. Boy, we were told about that thing, I think you fell on her. Sucked all the blood of the leaves, yeah, had this quail on her.
That's Mississippi Boll Weevil Blues, of course, by Charlie Patton. Read a little bit about this song, again, from that same essay that we've been reading from for most of the show. Charlie Patton's first recording session for Paramount Records took place on June 14, 1929, in the Jennett Studio at Richmond, Indiana. Interestingly, the same place where Louis Armstrong recorded some of his first sides. This is in the time of acoustic microphones now, which is another reason why things sound a little bit noisy and scratchy. The 14 songs that he recorded at this session give a remarkable insight into his personality and his main concerns. This is especially true of the first 4 songs, making it appear that Patton wanted to tell his audience emphatically who he was and what was on his mind. Curiously, he began his recorded legacy not with a blues song about himself, but on a more objective and symbolic level, with a version of a folk ballad titled Mississippi Boll Weevil Blues. There it is, the very first song that he actually recorded that we just heard. The boll weevil is a little black insect that bores into the cotton bud, preventing it from blossoming. It swarmed into Texas from Mexico in the early 1890s, and moving at a rate of about 60 miles a year, reached Mississippi in the early 20th century. It devastated the Delta cotton plantation and acted as a great leveler between whites and blacks. Many writers have pointed out how black farmers identified with the boll weevil despite the difficulties the insect created for blacks as well as whites. Despite every effort to control it, the boll weevil survived and spread, defying every force that the rich and powerful planters could muster against it, making its home on their plantations and forcing them to come to terms with it. Charlie Patton in particular must have identified with this insect that was constantly on the move, looking for a home. Several of his verses clearly reveal the appeal of this subject for him. Patton's next song that we're going to play is called Down the Dirt Road Blues. It's brilliant both as a performance and as a composition. According to Recording Sessions Ledger, the song's original title, and probably Patton's own title, was Over the Sea Blues. This would have been a better title as it suggests the expansiveness of Patton's imagination and that he was capable of thinking in universal terms. The song provides an important insight into Patton's deepest concerns about his own identity and purpose in life. The first and last stanzas serve to create a framework for the song and state his overriding concern. Patton is going down a dark road to a world unknown. He doesn't know what the future holds for him, but he says that he won't let himself be worried. Later on, he states that his woman is trying to drag him down and that she doesn't really care about him or his concerns. He knows that he needs a woman's company, however, so he will take one with him on his journey. If he can't take his own, quote, high brown, unquote, he will take another man's. In the midst of these thoughts about the directions of his life and his relationship to women, he deals with the question of his own identity. He introduces this theme with a remarkable image of frustration and rage. He says, I feel like chopping. Then, in a series of extraordinary allusions, he deals with his own racial ambiguity, expressing the problem in terms of racial homelands. Quote, the nation, unquote, can only mean one thing. It is the Indian Nation, which became part of the state of Oklahoma in 1907. Did Charlie make some kind of pilgrimage there earlier in his life? Or did his black Indian grandmother perhaps take him there for a visit? He seems to be saying so. There are actually communities of black Indians in Oklahoma. In any case, whether he really traveled there or only did so in his imagination, Patton states that somehow he found it impossible to maintain an Indian identity. No doubt this was true. His racial makeup may have been more Indian than anything else, but his only strong cultural link was through his grandmother, and even she had to live out her life in the Deep South, where everything was viewed in black and white. The last stanza must refer to Europe, the home of white people. Charlie had not been there himself, but his brother had fought there in a white folks' war, unquote, and could hardly have brought back a very favorable report. Charlie knew that he couldn't fully participate in white society, and he seems to be saying it obliquely in this stanza. He also must refers to the Delta, the Negro's home, where every day seemed like murder. Patton certainly could have played the role of a Negro and probably had to do so at times, but throughout his life, he seems to have done everything possible to resist this classification. Patton does not really resolve his dilemma. He simply heads for, quote, a world unknown and vows not to worry about it. Here is that track then. This is called Down the Dirt Road Blues. Lord, but I couldn't stay there. you might notice. I mean, the thing about the blues is that there's so many artists obviously borrow from one another in so many ways. And on that track, you'd really hear the same thing in Going Down That Lonesome Road or Big Road Blues, Big Road by people like Robert Johnson and such. It's a common thing. Charlie does it as well. In fact, we'll be getting into that in just a short while. You're also hearing other voices on that track besides Charlie Patton. When he did this first recording session in June of 1929, he wasn't alone. There was actually two artists that were recorded back and forth. They sort of alternated during the recording session at Paramount. Charlie Patton would record a couple songs. Then the other man, whose name was Walter Hawkins, would step in and he would record some tracks. Occasionally they would do a little bit of work together. And there you could actually hear Walter Hawkins sort of like getting Charlie to prodding him on throughout the song. Rather cool thing. We'll play some of Walter Hawkins' tracks as well next week for certain. Of the two, though, it's quite obvious that the big star of the Delta, though, was Charlie Patton. The big star at this session was Charlie Patton. And he was doing well for himself. I'm going to keep referring to this essay because it's so awesome and so full of information. Again, this is, the essay by David Evans that appears in the box set, who is the Masked Marvel on Revenant Records. Charlie Patton made a good income from his music. Other blues artists like Son House are in agreement on this fact. Jake Martin, who was older than Charlie and raised in the same area west of Bolton, coming to Dockery's himself in 1916 and who played guitar and kazoo in many of the same contexts as Charlie, stated that he himself would make a minimum of $10 a night and once made as much as $75. Martin did farm work, raised a family, and did not pursue a musical career as seriously as Charlie did. Still, he emphasized that one could make much more doing nothing than he could farming. Being a musician is like doing nothing. It is likely that Charlie Patton had an average income between $50 and $100 per week, all from, quote, doing nothing, unquote. In contrast, a successful sharecropper might be lucky to clear a few hundred dollars once a year before Christmas at settlement time and make a little extra money during the off-season for arduous work at a levee, lumber, or railroad camp. Otherwise, the sharecropper had to support himself and his family on the meager furnish provided by his boss man, which was charged against his settlement at the end of the year. Charlie's niece described the kind of money he would make from music. Her quote, "He have a sack of money every time he would go and come back, and he would take that money and pin it to his pajamas and sleep with it under his legs. Then his wife, he would call me and say, 'Come here and look at this sack of money Charlie got between his legs.'" His nephew also describes his prosperity. After he left his daddy, he didn't do nothing but play music. He made a good living. He stayed in good shape. He made an excellent living because he would help his sisters. He'd made it and distribute it around amongst them. He'd make them all happy. He kept a car. First car he ever drove was a Model T Ford. He'd get a new car every year. He first started getting little old T models. Then, the year he died, he just got a new Chevrolet. Besides his car, Charlie's main possessions would have been his clothes and his guitars. Tom Cannon adds, "He always wore a suit every day of his life. I never saw him with nothing but a suit on the whole time I knowed him. He wore his suits and shined shoes and a different woman every year, two a year sometimes. He just was a special person amongst people. He didn't go like no working man. He'd travel around in his car, drive around mostly by car until he'd get ready to go up north somewhere. He'd leave his car at his brother's, and he'd catch the train back in them days. He'd kept two or three guitars. He had them fixed up. On one of his guitars, he had a lot of gold pieces plastered all on it. He had them real fixed up to play them. He kept some special stuff to play with. He had gold coins all the way round his main box he used all the time. He had three. He kept his boxes dressed up. He was dressed up himself all the time. He loved his good clothes and shoes. He wore a Stetson hat." So obviously, we're not talking about somebody who's that much of a who is struggling, at least certainly not by the standards of the people around him. And then on top of that, he was also selling enough recordings. In fact, the next track we want to play is his biggest hit. So let's a quick excerpt on this one. Patton's fourth recording at the first session was called Pony Blues, released on Paramount number 12792. It was his first released hit song, and his biggest hit, also, and his signature song. It deals with the problem of establishing and maintaining relationships with women and opens with a traditional stanza that seems to take up where the previous song left off. In the fourth stanza, Patton expresses his preference for brown-skinned women in a striking simile, and he spurns black women. In his sixth and final stanza, he opts for temporary relationships with women without the legal obligations of marriage. Each stanza reflects real patterns in Patton's own life. Here is Pony Blues.
It has been my pony that left my black man. It has been my pony that left my black man.
Pony Blues, the biggest, most well-known song by Charlie Parton. Biggest is, of course, a relative term. It was also, this is at a point, you have to remember now, 1929 is just before the Depression. And his label, Paramount, was already having difficulties financially. So it was the first record that got the biggest push and was therefore his biggest hit. His subsequent records didn't sell as well, but they certainly added to his legacy and his reputation. One other thing I should say, when I was talking about Down the Dirt Road Blues, I definitely should have mentioned Tommy Johnson as well for Big Road, as he was the person most responsible for disseminating the themes of that song. Now, since we're talking about how these songs are overlapping and the themes are overlapping, I think it would be a good idea to try to follow one utilizing the very people that we've already played so far. Really, the only people we've played on show one and show two so far is Papa Charlie Jackson and Charlie Patton. And there's a bit of a connection here because we have a track recorded by Papa Charlie Jackson that predates Charlie Patton that leads us into a theme that was eventually covered by Patton. So what you can hear now is like sort of the development of the blues. If you move from the style of the sort of like the rag hokum style, as it you could call it, of Papa Charlie Jackson, and then find how it progresses to the blues in the hands of Charlie Patton. And then from there, as it moves on and it gets re-recorded by yet another Charlie, this time a man named Charlie Jordan, who recorded a little bit after Charlie Patton as well. The song is called Spoonful. We all know it now. I mean, if you're a fan of rock and roll, everybody knows Spoonful as a song that was eventually covered by Cream. And Cream picked it up from versions of songs that were recorded at Chess Records and such, and Willie Dixon. This is the roots of the song going all the way back to the mid-early 1920s. And we'll play, as I said, the three versions back-to-back. The song is can be interpreted in many ways. It can be a quite frank sexual allusion to the byproduct of the sex act. It could also be considered a song about cocaine, as in what you would need in order to huff some coke up your nose. Either way, it's either a sexual or a drug song that seemed to be have a theme that was common among most blues performers. So let's hear these in order then. First, you're going to hear Papa Charlie Jackson. Then you're going to hear Charlie Patton, the man of the hour, followed by a version by Charlie Jordan. Here is Spoonful.
I'm a fool about my
forget my baby. You know I need my. It means on porridge moon the lifetime. Just about up. Hey, baby, you know I ain't long. How about now? All I want is this treasure. Tears up. I go to bed. You don't want to fight about her.
Look here, baby. Would you slap me? Yes, I will.
Just about up. Baby, you know I'm a fool. About now.
Would you kill a man? Yes, I will. You know I'll kill him.
Just about up. Oh, dear me,
that you see it.
Fool about it.
You know, baby, I mean
that old. Baby,
I want to hear the gentleman.
About up.
Baby, you won't quit me?
Yeah, huh? Just about up. It's all I want, baby. This treasure, you know.
Look at here, baby. I'm leaving town.
Just about up. Baby, you know I need that up.
Don't make me mad, baby.
All I want, my.
Couldn't get that spoonful. I said, look here, gal, don't you fool with me about my spoonful. I walk the street all night long looking for my spoonful. I'm a spoonful. I said, look here, gal, only fooling me about that spoonful. It's a spoonful, it's a spoonful. My baby cried all night long for a spoonful. She thought that she wasn't gonna get that little old spoonful. Police called me, he knocked me down for a spoonful. I caught the train, I left the town for a spoonful.
Naturally, you hear Charlie Jordan doing a version of the song that is obviously very much influenced by Charlie Patton's version, sort of really just a cleaner recording of more or less the same thing without the asides. Patton's is certainly the darkest and the most mysterious of the three that we played there. All variations of Spoonful Blues. Papa Charlie Jackson's title was All I Want is a Spoonful. Spoonful Blues, Charlie Patton, and Just a Spoonful, as recorded by Charlie Jordan. All the same song, basically. Here's another example of a song being developed, and a very interesting one for Charlie Patton in particular. It's called Tom Russian Blues. In the song, Charlie Patton actually gave the first indication of his propensity for making a song out of, quote, anything that come kind of odd, as that was his niece's description of how he would write. Perhaps for the first time in recorded blues, a singer mentions local white people in a song and even offers some unfavorable criticism of one of them, notably Tom Day, the town marshal of Marigold. The discussion of national political issues is fairly uncommon in the blues, but discussions of local issues and politicians is almost non-existent. To do so was quite daring for a man who had lived in the Delta a long time and expected to stay there. Perhaps it is of some significance that after his first recording session, Patton seems to have increased his traveling and was seen less often around Dockery's, Cleveland, Marigold, and Mound Bayou. Now, the person that the song is named after, Tom Rushing, was actually a person born in 1898 near Mississippi, near Tylertown, Mississippi, and moved with his parents to the Delta around 1910 when the boll weevil devastated the family farm. He was a Marine officer training program during World War I and served in the Navy during most of the 1920s. He married and returned to the Delta, settling in Marigold, and he immediately became a deputy for Sheriff Joe Smith of Bolivar County. His main duty was breaking up moonshine stills and arresting the moonshiners who made it and the bootleggers who sold it. He remained a deputy sheriff until 1932 when Prohibition was repealed. Bonded whiskey became legal again, and the Delta counties voted almost immediately to allow its sale. Moonshining and bootlegging decreased dramatically, and Russian found that he couldn't make as much money as before. So he took a job as a tractor salesman and bought a farm east of Marigold with his savings. Russian himself thought well of Patton, and the feeling was probably mutual, as Patton gave Russian a copy of this record that he kept for many years. It would appear that Rushing was, as he stated, quote, a pretty important figure among the Negroes, unquote, and Patton wanted to honor him in a song. On the other hand, Holloway, the song's moonshiner, was a friend of Patton's and probably an important figure in his own right. Patton probably sympathized with his plight and wanted to call attention to it in a song. He apparently did so by merging his own character with Holloway's, using the first person as if Patton were singing about his own experiences. This is a common technique of blues composers, obviously, but Patton may have been induced to compose this in this way because he's actually basing this track on a song that was written and released by Ma Rainey called Booze and Blues. That's the song that really provides the basic structure for this song. So let's hear, we'll end the show by playing Ma Rainey's song, Booze and Blues, and then we'll let that go right into the song we were just talking about by Charlie Patton called Tom Russian Blues. And I hope you enjoy these, and I hope that you can join us again next week as we continue our nice, deep little look into Charlie Patton and some of his contemporaries with the Mississippi Delta Blues. Meanwhile, here is Booze and Blues by Ma Rainey, followed by Tom Russian Blues by Charlie Patton. Take care, everybody.
Bed last night and full of flowers in my feet. Yeah. I went to bed last night and I was in my feet. Woke up this morning, the police was shaking me. Thank you. myself where there ain't no food. My life is all a misery when I cannot get my food. I can't live without my liquor. Got to have the booze to kill these blues. It seems like years and I still out where there is no